Good morning and welcome. I want to begin, as we often do, with a land acknowledgement. And the boilerplate of that acknowledgement is that when we gather on Treaty 1 territory. And that land, this land, is the homeland of several people groups that are not the ones whose sort of ethnic history dominate our community. That's not mostly who where we're from in terms of people groups. A lot more kind of Eurocentric ancestry and colonial ancestry in our community. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to acknowledge this. That said, whenever we do, we're touching on a bunch of other things as well. And I want to mention some of those this morning. In particular, today, when we acknowledge that when we gather gratefully on Treaty 1 land, we are interacting with a whole different wisdom tradition than that Eurocentric one that most of us are most familiar with. We're interacting with a tradition that emphasizes the wisdom of those that have gone before, of the elders, of those whose shoulders we stand on. Both the elders that we know and the elders, you know, the ones that are around us now, and those that we don't know personally but whose wisdom we have in other forms. And some traditions, of course, are stronger on this than others for a variety of reasons. And not the least of those reasons is the relationship that particular traditions might have with the values of the Enlightenment. Those are values like the sovereignty of reason and the evidence of the senses as the primary source of how we know things. Also with ideals, and particularly European notions of ideals like liberty or progress, toleration, fraternity, constitutional government, separation of church and state. I mean, it's quite a list, right? But these are some of the hallmarks of Enlightenment that have shaped European thought, which have shaped the thinking of many of us, whether we're aware of it or not. We're not going to go into that list in any detail this morning, but I wanted to mention it now because part of what we will get into this morning is a reading of a possibly familiar biblical text, in this case a Hebrew text, with perhaps a little different emphasis than the one that's familiar to those of us who've grown up in or around the Western Christian tradition, most of which really still, in most of its sort of current forms, is still pretty besotted with things like ideas about certainty, and those ideas are rooted in Enlightenment ideas like the sovereignty of reason. And so, anyway, I wanted to connect those dots because there's a whole bunch of things running in the background that it helps us to foreground once in a while when we just stop and go, listen, we're on Treaty 1 land. We're intersecting with a bunch of things, not just, and air quotes for just, we're intersecting with a lot of things, not just a treaty, not just an agreement. We're intersecting with a collision of worldviews that happened a long time ago and that is still happening. And there's some real good there as well as some real challenges. And so I wanted to kind of start there. Certainty, let's just say, is a flag that's at half mast right now for a lot of us and for a lot of the world in general. Cultures that have developed under worldviews other than those that feature certainty don't necessarily have that same tendency. And they might be more inclined in general to celebrate things, as in contrast to certainty, they might be more inclined to celebrate things like wisdom. And wisdom, I'm going to contend, is every bit as powerful as certainty, but far more fluid. I think that's a really important aspect of wisdom. However, regardless of what sort of worldview we've grown up with or what sort of culture we've grown up with, we have some access to other worldviews and cultures. We can learn from what we're surrounded by if we choose to do so. And some of the traditions that are all around us right here in this part of the continent are those of our indigenous kinfolk. And those are traditions that often draw heavily on the wisdom of the elders and of those that have gone before. We'll come back to all that later, but I wanted to mark it now at the outset and to do so in the context of our land acknowledgement because, as I said, when we acknowledge the geography and the history of this moment, we're also just
walking right into that whole bigger conversation every time. We might not always be conscious of it, and I think it's important to stop and be conscious of it. All right, let's take a few moments and breathe together. I feel the need to pause this morning and be more centered, and then we'll get into it. All right? Okay, so what we'll do together this morning is just very, very simple exercise. As regards breathing, I just want us to breathe in deeply and breathe out fully. No counting, nothing like that. But while we're breathing, excuse me, while we're breathing, just take your hands and as you breathe, just touch your fingers together. Boom. As you go. Boom. Boom. Just all the way through to all your fingers are in contact with one another. Misty's, I may get the term wrong, but when Misty and Judy did their thing a couple of weeks ago, Misty talked about the bilateral tapping and mentioned that this is a way of connecting our brains to back to our bodies, and sort of instead of our thoughts being this disembodied thing. And so it just connects our bodies, our brains to our bodies to our breath, and our breath to life. So all these things are kind of interwoven. So let's just breathe together. For me, that'll be five breaths because I'll use one per finger, you know, but you do whatever you want. And as always, please, if this is not your thing, you know, don't do it. Just take a break and we'll get going on ideas here shortly, and we can be all about our brains for a while if we want to. All right, let's breathe together. Here we go. Thank you. I love that we get to do that together, even if it doesn't always feel like we're together. Hang on, I got to just make an adjustment here. All right. Okay, let's get into this. Oh, I meant to mention as well that if you're joining us by podcast, I added out the breathing time because it's very strange to have a big chunk of silence in a podcast. We're not used to that. But you can always just hit pause and fire it up again if you want to stop to breathe with all of us. We are, generally speaking, pretty great at seeing what we expect or what we want to see. And this is well-studied matter. Our brains like shortcuts. So when we hit the answer that we want or the explanation that's familiar or comforting, we tend to stop looking. It's just, you know, life is just easier that way. It's also one of the things that we have evolved in order to survive as a species. And it's super powerful. It's very deeply rooted in us. In fact, it's so powerful that if we encounter something that challenges one of those shortcut answers, our bodies can automatically go into fight or flight mode. We don't have to reason our way to that. It just happens when we hit something that's contrary to what we're expecting. And when our bodies do that, we just get this squirt of extra energy. We're just, our bodies are ready to, you know, run from angry tribesperson, saber-toothed tiger, pick one. But we're equipped to just, like, you know, get on with it. However, in our modern world, we have a relatively shorter supply of concrete immediate physical threats. It's not that they're not there, but they're fewer. And so, but our bodies still do that. So the way we experience that, if we hit something that's different than the shortcut we thought we were taking, and we get that energy, we just experience it as stress. And that's no fun. Now, we don't all respond to stressors the same. Some of us, it seems, bounce back from stress a lot more readily than others of us. I think this is going to be clear enough as we go, but just to say it really plainly at the outset, our ability to deal positively with stressors is not some kind of sign of superiority. We're not a better brand of human because we respond better to stressors than someone who doesn't seem to deal as well. We'll kind of get into more of the nuances of that, but I want to just make that super clear right at the beginning. Because a belief like that, I respond better to stressors because I'm a better human than you somehow, that might be a really tidy idea and often a conveniently self-serving one as well. But the reality is, you know, a wee bit more complicated than that. So we'll get into it. As I mentioned briefly last week, the field of study that is probed pretty directly into the question of why some people bounce back more than others is generally associated with the label resiliency. And one time, I should just say, I should just say before we really get rolling here, one time when we were doing one of our community check-ins, Ariel commented that sometimes my talky bits feel a little bit like being in university class. And then because Ariel's a kind person, she quickly said, not that that's a bad thing, which was very, very lovely. Thank you, Ariel. I think that's fair, both the observation and the kindness. I really appreciate that. But just FYI, this next bit is backgrounding and it's information oriented. And so it might feel a little bit like that. Just, you know, brace yourself. Anyway, back to resiliency. Resiliency is a relatively young discipline. The person that really kind of launched that ship was an American psychologist named Norman Garmetsi. And Garmetsi did his best known research in the second half of the 1990s. So, you know, really recently. And he was especially interested in risk resilience, stress, and coping in childhood development. That was where he kind of got going. So what he did is he started by going into schools and focused his research particularly on schools that were in economically depressed areas. And he followed a standard protocol when he went into schools. He'd set up a meeting with the principal, along with the school social worker or nurse, and then he would pose the same question, which was, were there any children whose backgrounds had initially raised red flags, kids who seemed likely to become so-called problem kids, who had become instead, surprisingly, in the school context, a source of pride? In a 1999 interview, he described the process this way. He said, what I was saying was, can you identify stressed children who are making it here in your school? And there would be a long pause after my inquiry before the answer came. If I had said, do you have kids in this school who seem to be troubled? There wouldn't have been a moment's delay. But to be asked about children who were adaptive and good citizens in the school and making it even though they had come out of very disturbed backgrounds, that was a new sort of inquiry. That's the way we began. Close quote. Garmetsi's research changed the direction of focus on the questions related to how we respond to negative life events and trauma. And prior to his studies, most of the emphasis had been on finding areas of vulnerability. So who was more likely to have difficult life outcomes when faced with those kind of events? And Garmetsi's mission was to probe the question, what are the protective factors? What are the elements of an individual's background or personality that could enable success despite the challenges that they faced? Now, Garmetsi died early onset. Alzheimer's was the illness that he that came to the fore later in his life, but he died before his work could come to any clear conclusions. But the people that built on what he had started kind of got down to these two categories in terms of a response to what are the protective factors. They kind of got it down to these two big chunks: individual psychological factors and external environmental factors, or if you want to put it into sort of more colloquial language, disposition on the one hand, and circumstances or luck, or for that matter, often systemic injustices on the other. But what was the environment, you know? Now, in 1989, there was another study, developmental psychologist named Emmy Werner. And Werner published the results of a 32-year longitudinal project. That is a long project. She followed a group of 698 children in Kauai, Hawaii, from before birth through to their third decade of life. Oh, man. Anyway, she monitored them for all kinds of stressors along the way, everything from in utero stress to their life circumstances and events. It's pretty fascinating stuff, but and extensive. Obviously, she had a mountain of data by the time she was done, but I'm going to sum it up for our purposes this morning this way. Of approximately 30% of the group, which she would have identified as at risk based on where they were coming from in terms of their external environment, about one third of that group showed noteworthily stronger resilience than others. And Werner found several elements that predicted resilience. And again, sort of boils down to three kind of categories or factors. The resilient kids were more likely to have the good fortune of a strong bond with a supportive caregiver, parent, teacher, or some other mentor-like figure.
In psychological terms, they also tended to meet the world on their own terms. They tended to be autonomous and independent, and they tended to seek out new experiences. Werner put it this way. She wrote, though not especially gifted, these children used whatever skills they had effectively, close quote. So that was sort of her language for that. And the third set of factors was that the more resilient kids had what psychologists call an internal locus of control. In everyday language, they believed that they, not their circumstances, affected their achievements. Or, again, to put it sort of into almost an idiomatic form, they saw themselves as the orchestrators of their own fates. Which is all pretty interesting. And it also leaves open the question, if we generally all have fundamentally the same stress response system, which evolved over millions of years, why do some of us use that system more frequently or more effectively than others? Well, the very short answer, the very abbreviated answer, is perception. How we think about life events and circumstances. And again, in an almost dangerously abbreviated form, because this stuff can be really complex, our resiliency is tied to whether we view life events as traumatic or as opportunities to learn and grow. So, you know, there we go again with here's an either or, when of course this is far more nuanced than that, and yet the either ors can help us consider it. There are some very real and very important limits to this concept, not the least of which are those that attend to the impact of violent traumas, so abrupt or even abbreviated violent events in our lives of a traumatic nature. And the field of trauma studies is a burgeoning one at the moment as well, and so there's information coming into these ideas from that field of study all the time. I'm not going to go there this morning, because what I want to do is plug what we already have into some of the ancient wisdom that I was talking about at the beginning, but it's well worth exploring and fascinating stuff. Now, just so you know, we are, in terms of ideas, on a bit of an inevitable collision course here between some of those Enlightenment values that I talked about at the beginning and a story whose values reflect much older perspectives. All of this psychological research we've been talking about is built on ideas about the value of coming up with a hypothesis and then testing that hypothesis through observation and quantification. Again, very sort of Enlightenment-grounded approach to what we would broadly use the term science for. And the story we're going to look at, the ancient story, isn't grounded in those same kind of values, like, at all. It's considerably pre-Enlightenment. What's fascinating to me is the overlap between the two. So here's the ancient bit, as we might encounter it today. If you hang around people who tend to quote the Bible as a referent for how to view the world around us and God's place in it, you might have heard somebody quote this verse lately, or, you know, in the context of the global upheaval of the pandemic. The location for the verse, in terms of the Christian library called the Bible, is Jeremiah 29:11, which says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." Now, if you've heard somebody quote that verse recently, odds are pretty good that it was meant to be comforting. And it could be a comforting verse, right? This idea that God, imagined as an all-powerful being, has not only our present tense best in mind, but also this better future, which makes that better future inevitable. That's reassuring, right? That's hopeful. That's the kind of belief that can encourage us when we need it most. And these days, lots of us, I think, feel like we need it. Now, we could use that brain shortcut I talked about earlier and stop right there. If that's the idea we were looking for and we found it and it felt comforting and reassuring, we could just say, we're done. Got it. That's how I thought the world worked. We could treat that like the whole story. God has plans for my future, for our future. They're good plans. So even if things seem like they're kind of going off the rails right now, it's going to be okay. And we could even treat that perspective as certain. And holding that perspective would be easiest if we were surrounded by other folks who also thought of it as certain. Which, by the way,
can also be part of the groundwork of resiliency, that connection to community. Some people, when they encounter trauma and you ask what the impact of it was on their life, they say that it took them deeper into community or closer to community. That's a way of responding to that that can build an aspect of resiliency. However, it's important that we not take the shortcut on this one, because we might short-circuit the further growth of that same trait of resiliency. If we take that verse alone and say that it's the foundation of our certainty, we will have done both the text and ourselves a significant disservice. The key to recognizing what we might be missing is to pay attention to the context for that verse. This verse is taken from a letter that the prophet Jeremiah is writing to a group of Israelites that have been exiled. They're exiles. They have been taken from their homes and they have been forced to live elsewhere. There's no known date of return. In other words, everything they thought they knew has been totally upended. The circumstances could be regarded as a premium test case for questions about resiliency. If ever a group of people needed to deal as well as possible with adversity, it was these folks. And we might look at a verse like that and think, well, Jeremiah is saying that God, because as a prophet, the people of this culture would have regarded him as a spokesperson for the divine, God is going to fix all this, so that settles it. It's going to be okay. I don't know if this is an apt metaphor, if it'll connect for you, but in a lot of ways, when you think about pre-Enlightenment peoples or people groups that, especially ancient people groups and cultures that were looking for some way to understand their world, as we all do as humans, you know how we sometimes we'll use a phrase like we'll say, well, science says, or science proves, or whatever, and we would treat science as though it were almost a someone, not a something. In a lot of ways, that's very comparable to the way an ancient culture would have regarded their deity or thought about God. Well, God says, and so Jeremiah is like the radio expert, the scientist who says of COVID such and so. Well, science says, well, God says. So they would have, the culture and the people in the culture would have listened to that statement from Jeremiah with the same kind of, that's got some heft to it, that we might listen to a statement from a scientist who's done their homework on a particular topic, which is kind of an interesting comparison. So Jeremiah's, we could look at the verse and we could think, well, Jeremiah's saying that God is going to fix all this, and so good, right? We've got a vaccine and it works. It's been tested. So it's going to be good, if you will. And if the people believed it, what Jeremiah was saying, and they thought about it that way, that's where their resiliency came from. They would now confidently move their locus of control from themselves to God and carry on in a hopeful manner. God's got this. That's where the control is. The deity's got this in hand. We can just rest with that. And here's what's interesting about that verse, though. It's preceded by these verses. This is still Jeremiah writing, still talking as a divine spokesperson. This is what he writes to the same group of people. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. We're not going to get into it right now. It's a big theme in Jeremiah, though. But that little phrase, to which I have carried you into exile, that's like, that if you need a bumper sticker, well, bumper sticker, you need something bigger than that. If you need a neon sign in the sky about what perspective on the divine these people are working with in terms of locus of control, that's it. Like Jeremiah is basically saying to the people, you're in this mess because God put you in it. Like God's in control of everything, like a puppet master or a chess master. They're just moving you around for their purposes. So you'll learn something in this case, as Jeremiah's message. So you'll get back to the way we believed before and the things we were doing before. So you'll kind of get it sorted, and then you get to go back home. Anyway. In terms of locus of control, that's the phrase that kind of gives the whole game away. But
it's set into this fascinating, contrasting set of statements. Because it's like the message that the prophet Jeremiah is sending to people who are really struggling with their circumstances is, don't waste the exile. Don't look at these incredibly challenging circumstances. And there's no doubt, like, there's no denial in the text that the challenges are incredibly incredibly difficult. Don't look at these challenging circumstances as the end. Look at them as an opportunity to not just survive while waiting for God to fix things, but to act, to use whatever agency you have under the circumstances. We could characterize it as moving away from the kind of perspective that can easily be fostered by what I would call religious parentalism, this kind of learned helplessness that depends on what a religious authority figure is telling us, quote, God says, and basically just waiting for something better to happen and calling that whole way of looking at the world faith. This is a change in perspective that says this is not the whole story. It's a slice of the story. This isn't my whole life. This is a moment in my life. That change in perspective can be instrumental in helping us to take the next most important step in building resiliency, which is simply to do something. Maybe I shouldn't have used simply and do something in proximity like that, because doing something can be both incredibly difficult and incredibly ordinary. Sometimes doing something is just getting out of bed. And if you've ever been decked by depression or one of its relatives, then you know what I'm talking about. All the things that Jeremiah lists, you know, all those everyday things, plant a garden, grow something, eat it, take care of your kids and your family, help them find people they love, commit to those people, ground themselves, have their own families, plant their own gardens, invest in the culture around you, do what you can to see that it does well in everyday ways. All of those things that Jeremiah lists are things that the exiles can do. It's not a list of what they might have been capable of under other more supportive or better known circumstances. Jeremiah goes out of his way at another point in the same letter to point out that many of the folks that have been exiled are skilled artisans, teachers, leaders. They're if you want to use sort of vertical structural language for it, they're the elite. They're the best equipped people of the society. They've been exiled. The things that they could do under their other circumstances that they maybe did every day, that was their job, that was their life, their livelihood, their reason for being, those are things that are no longer available to them to do under exile. They don't get to do either what they did, or they don't get to do it like they did it. But here's a list, says Jeremiah, of ordinary things that they can do, that we can do. They're representative. In our conversation, they become a metaphor for doing ordinary things like getting out of bed. It's like Jeremiah is saying, you want to know the better future that I'm talking about? Then get out of bed, even if it's really hard to do, and put your feet on the floor and go out into the world you find yourself in and do what you can. It might feel like those are really simple things, like they're everyday things, like they are so ordinary, they are no big deal. Anyone should be able to do this any day. Not true. They are the keys that unlock your ability to get through today and that equip you to recognize and grow your capacity to participate in that better future when it comes. We could view this story as one that stands quite brilliantly at the complicated intersection of the ancient and the contemporary. It points toward ideas about the divine that in many cases have been co-opted by Enlightenment hubris and turned into Western theologies about certainty and systems of religious codependence, while simultaneously reminding us that resiliency does not arrive in a package marked complete. Not now, not ever. It grows when we choose to till the soil that we're on with the tools that we have, when we do ordinary things that remind us that the very spark of divine life that is in every one of us is what points toward that better future. Maybe this is our exile of the moment. Some of us are feeling it more acutely than others. If you're in isolation, perhaps that metaphor of exile feels a little more acute. Or if you're waiting for test results, or if you know or are in proximity to someone relationally that is ill or that has suffered from this illness or perhaps died from it, maybe that exilic feeling is deeper and stronger. But for all of us, perhaps an approachable metaphor. Maybe this is our exile of the moment. If so, let's not waste it.